This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Carly Huckles.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. The Department of Homeland Security has announced a proposed regulation that would change U.S. immigration policy, and it's already having a negative impact in Colorado.
We'll hear that story, and then a lot of 911 calls coming into the Greeley Fire Department are not for actual emergencies.
Something that you or I might call a friend for or a family member. You know, hey, I need a ride to pick up my prescription, or I need a ride to my doctor's appointment. They don't have that.
We hear what that department is doing to limit the number of frequent callers.
And later, we'll hear about a unique club in Fort Collins. And as always, a film review from our critic Howie Moshevitz. But first, British artist Stuart Semple's six-week art intervention called Happy City, Art for the People, focused on using public art to break down social barriers and nurture well-being. I wish I could have gone to see this. It featured exhibits like Happy Face Bubble Clouds and an inflatable dance floor that popped up in the middle of downtown.
Meanwhile, researchers studied several of the works to gauge the project's success, including the installation Emotional Baggage Drop, which allowed commuters at Union Station to anonymously share their feelings with strangers. The goal? To encourage feelings of empathy and social connection.
Mitchell Reardon is a senior lead researcher at Happy City. That's the consulting group that completed the study.
In the iPhone age, everybody's staring at their phone. You don't think that any stranger wants to connect with you in a public space. And when given the chance and, you know, having this sort of novel way of doing so, people were very much drawn to this.
In a survey, participants initially were less optimistic and trusting of others. After going through the installation, they reported feeling more open and willing to express greater vulnerability.
Higher-than-average snowpack is easing drought conditions in parts of the state. KUNC's Luke Runyon has more.
The last week has piled on the snow in Colorado's high country. That's leading state climatologists to suggest portions of the western slope could see some marginal improvements in drought conditions. The region's record hot and dry weather this past summer drained reservoirs and rivers. Now drought conditions are easing in the headwaters of the Colorado, Yampa, and White Rivers. The state is far from being out of the woods just yet. Some of the driest winters on record have started out strong only to peter out later in the spring. And snowpack is currently below average in some southern Colorado river basins. Luke Runyon, KUNC.
Early October, the Department of Homeland Security announced a proposed regulation that would change U.S. immigration policy. It would affect people who want or have a visa, who want to obtain a green card, or become a lawful permanent resident. But as KUNC's Stephanie Daniel reports, the proposal is already having a negative impact in Colorado.
A mí me gustaría un minutito nada más.
Erica Serrano is leading a recent monthly meeting in the small agricultural town of Fort Morgan, about 80 miles northeast of Denver.
Que con su pareja, ¿verdad?
She's pairing up a group of about 12 immigrant and refugee women.
Quickly share, what is one thing or a couple things that come to mind for you to be able to take action for your health or for the health of others?
Serrano oversees the Morgan Health Connectors, the group formed about a year ago.
My role is to guide and facilitate their leadership so that they share their voice, their needs, and then they're empowered to take action.
The women learn about issues like sexual assault and healthcare so they can be knowledgeable advocates within their community, which has a high immigrant population. Right now, they're focusing on the proposed changes to public charge.
Federal law generally requires that the foreign nationals seeking to come to or remain in the United States be able to support themselves financially and not be dependent on the public to meet their needs.
In this YouTube clip, Francis Cisna is explaining public charge, which determines how much an immigrant is likely to use government assistance. Cisna is the director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services.
This determination is based on a review of the totality of the alien circumstances, including these mandatory factors: age, health, family, status, assets, resources, and financial status.
If an immigrant is likely to become a public charge, they could be denied entry into the country or unable to adjust their status. The law only applies to certain immigrants who have long-term medical care or need cash assistance for most of their financial support. The Department of Homeland Security is proposing a number of changes. One is to add more public benefits to the public charge test.
Any sort of publicly funded nutritional assistance program, housing assistance program, medical or prescription assistance program.
Violeta Chapin is a law professor at the University of Colorado Law School in Boulder. While DHS officials have said that immigrants must be able to support themselves financially, Chapin believes there's more to it.
This administration makes no bones about the fact that they are not receptive to immigrants, I think, in general. And they certainly don't want poor immigrants to come to the United States.
These changes haven't taken effect, but immigrants in Colorado are still fearful. And Martha Solario is hearing about this fear in Fort Morgan. She joined the Morgan Health Connectors about 4 months ago.
Si he oído miedos, como
Solario says immigrants have told her they are scared.
Ahora está teniendo estos miedos porque ahora
and feel the odds are further stacked against them to get their documents and become legal residents.
Para poder alcanzar y llegar a tener sus documentos para estar aquí legales.
Some have even begun to disenroll or not sign up for public benefits, and it's extending beyond individual immigrants.
It is so complex. People don't understand it. They are so afraid that they're just refusing.
Mitzi Moran is CEO of Sunrise Community Health, which operates 10 clinics serving mainly low-income families in Evans, Greeley, and Loveland.
We have had 50 families that have refused to sign their children up, their eligible children, their citizen children, up for benefits for fear that it will impact a family member's ability to become a citizen.
And according to a report from the Kaiser Family Foundation, nearly 5 million adults and children could disenroll from Medicaid or the Children's Health Insurance Program if the rules go through.
Todavía estamos actuando fuerte contra la carga pública. We are still acting very strongly and taking action for public charge.
Back at the Morgan Health Connectors meeting, Erica Serrano wraps up with one last call to action.
Again, if you know of someone who's being directly affected, connect them to me. Otra vez, si conocen a alguien.
The group has already hosted several events encouraging the immigrant population in Fort Morgan to speak up and submit a comment against public charge before the 60-day public comment period ends on December 10th. The Department of Homeland Security will then review and consider the comments before issuing a final rule. Stephanie Daniel, KUNC, Fort Morgan.
When people call 911, it's not always for what you'd consider an emergency. Many times, the callers are in some kind of bind and can't think of anyone else to call. But these calls require a full response. Think firefighters, big trucks, police cars, EMTs that can quickly outsize the problem. In Greeley, the fire department has an innovative solution, as KUNC's Michael DeIwana reports.
At department headquarters in downtown Greeley, Squad 1 is about to deploy. They're making their way across the station to their truck. And though it's red, it's not a fire truck. It's more of an ambulance.
Watch that first step. It's easy.
The motor is already running because it's a cold day. I climb into the back and find a seat.
That chair is great for listening to what's coming in.
Today, I'm embedding with the department's most unusual team. Soon, we're on our way. And as we roll along a tree-lined street, I lean towards driver Darren Conradson.
Feels a little weird to be in a fire vehicle going on a call without the siren on.
Right, yes. We hardly ever use the siren.
In fact, Squad 1 has only used its lights and siren twice this year. That's because the crew are not firefighters. Conradson, for instance, is among a growing number of community paramedics who add preventative and public health care to the arsenal. He tells me about where we're going.
Just an elderly gentleman that lives at home by himself, doesn't have a whole lot of connections, people that check in on him. Healthcare is a big thing. He doesn't have any healthcare.
The other members of the crew include a crisis intervention counselor and experts at helping people navigate the world of benefits and social services. Paul Villa is 89. He's a former field and meat plant worker. Squad 1 has been to this small house before. 4 times already this year.
What's up?
We thought we'd stop in. We were in the neighborhood. Thought we would stop in and check in on
you. And while it may sound excessive for the fire department to check in on one person so often, the crew is working to get ahead of another problem. Frequent callers. Via has called 911 several times in the past. But some proactive steps could have prevented that.
So are you still good on your test strips?
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay. Glucometer, B good.
Mm-hmm. This is a very big change in culture and thought for the fire department.
That's Dale Lyman. In his 3 decades with the department, he's done every job, climbing the ladder to become its chief in 2016.
We're very traditional in how we do things, and this is...
What do you mean by that?
We like to send lots of people in big trucks to things.
But the problem with that, he says, is the department contends with a large number of 911 calls that simply aren't emergencies.
Something that you or I might call a friend for or a family member, you know, hey, I need a ride to pick up my prescription, or I need a ride to my doctor's appointment. They don't have that. So they get to a point where, well, I'll call 911 and you know, maybe... somebody can help me.
Since 2001, 911 call volume for the department has risen by more than 160%. Greeley's growing population is driving some of that, but so are other things.
The data, once we started looking at it, proved it. There is a segment of our population in our community that doesn't, I'll just say it, they don't have access to health care like you or I would.
The data also uncovered just how much impact frequent callers have on the system. In 2016, just 5 people were responsible for more than 200 911 calls. A homeless person and chronic alcohol abuser generated 86 calls and 86 trips to the emergency room. Another, with mental health problems, made 26 calls, requiring 20 trips to the ER.
It was insanity. We're sending this highly trained, expensive crew, fire apparatus, equipment for legitimate, big-scale problems just over and over again to these things that don't need that. But there's nobody else that's going to respond, so they respond and do what they can, and it was a vicious cycle.
When Squad 1 hit the streets in one of the department's old Chevy Suburbans in a pilot last year, the 911 calls didn't end. But those for frequent callers dropped significantly, especially when the team secured long-term services and or substance abuse help for them.
Thank God you stopped by.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, we'll see you.
Just outside of Paul Villa's house, the crew gauge where he's at and what they can do for him. Team member Meredith Munoz is also a coordinator with North Colorado Health Alliance and the Community Action Collaborative.
He's afraid to leave his home because he's afraid he will never come back.
Yeah.
So that has been one of the things about getting him into care is he's afraid if he goes and gets care, they're going to say, oh, you need to go to a nursing home or something.
And that's concerning to Jamie Clapp, a mental health therapist with North Range Behavioral Health.
I'm assessing his loneliness and if he's had contacts, because that can lead to a lot of physical problems. And we want to get him help and care, but we care about him. And we want to make sure that he doesn't lose contact with somebody.
Back at the department's headquarters, Chief Dale Lyman recalls one instance where a homeless man received counseling, resources, and found a job because of the interventions of Squad 1.
That's huge. You know, that's one less person that might be out on the streets or sleeping in the park because of a substance abuse problem, whatever the case may be.
He says the program is in step with the fire department's mission to prevent harm and be professional and compassionate. Even so, there are costs. Lyman carved out money for Squad 1 from a savings it created. That's because he doesn't have to send out his big engines to respond to as many 911 calls.
Less miles, less wear and tear, less fuel.
Nonprofits see the value too, helping to pay for the crew. And now, Squad 1 has more work than it can do on its current 40-hour-a-week schedule. The 4-person crew has run 353 911 calls since the beginning of February. But the need is much higher, perhaps more than double. So the chief hopes to secure more funding to staff Squad 1 for more hours in the future. Greeley's isn't the only fire department trying this approach. Agencies in Colorado Springs, as well as in New Mexico and Arizona, have their own versions of Squad 1, and even more across the country are starting to explore this idea. Michael DeOanna, KUNC.
Thank you.
Erin, I don't know about you, but I love writing cards. I think it's mostly just because I like getting mail in response.
Yeah.
But this past weekend, I sat down and wrote out like 20 thank you cards for things that I've missed throughout the year. And I spent some time organizing my stationery.
Well, you are organized.
I try.
I did not do that, but I do think you're right. There is something just more fulfilling about getting something that you can hold in your hands rather than just clicking open an email. And also when I get Christmas cards, I would tape them up over my front door. But I can't do that with an e-card.
You really can't.
It doesn't work. If it's been a while since you last sat down and wrote a letter, you're certainly not alone. But fans of correspondence are finding a place to practice the art of the handwritten word.
The words matter, of course, but knowing that someone's actually touched that paper, I like that.
We'll find out more about this unique club in just a little bit.
But before we get to that, the midterm elections ended almost a month ago, but campaign season isn't quite over in Denver. Next May, voters there will decide whether people experiencing homelessness can take shelter and sleep in public spaces. The practice known as urban camping was banned by city officials 6 years ago. KUNC's Scott Franz has more.
At any time of the day, it's not hard to find homeless individuals in Denver's Civic Center Park. People are socializing, sleeping on park benches, and sharing food as police cars cruise the perimeter. It's where I met Jerry Burton back in October.
My daughter got taken away from me, and my house got taken away from me.
And Burton ended up calling the park his home.
You're walking on pins and needles, you know? It's very hard to be woken up every morning by police or in the middle of the night.
2 years ago, he laid his sleeping bag in front of City Hall on a cold November night. Police told him to move on, but Burton refused. He was ticketed and the case went to trial. Ultimately, he was convicted of breaking Denver's ban on sleeping in public spaces.
We have laws here, but when you start putting laws on the book to affect one group or individual, something is wrong with that.
A police spokesman declined to comment on how the department is enforcing the camping ban. But according to their records, 32 people have been cited for violating the rules since they went into effect in 2012. But a group of city residents is hoping to change things.
Vote yes!
Vote yes!
Vote yes!
Thank you very much.
Diane Thiel is a leader of the Right to Survive initiative. In October, she and other campaign supporters gathered at Civic Center Park for a potluck. They thanked all the volunteers who spent weeks gathering more than 9,000 signatures.
You toiled on even when voters were rude to you or adamantly against our ballot initiative. You kept going.
Technically, she says they're breaking the very law they're hoping to overturn by sharing food and sitting on blankets. Then she picks up a sign that says Right to Rest and begins walking towards Colfax Avenue.
Used to be people would say not in my backyard, and now they say not in my world. They don't want to see poor people. They don't want to see homeless people anywhere they go. It's not just on their alley. And I think we need to encourage them to understand that everybody has constitutional rights to exist.
As she waves at passing cars, Thiel says the initiative to overturn the camping ban has faced several setbacks. The group spent the last 4 years asking the state legislature to overturn it, but it never gained traction.
My thinking is we need to be like water. When you meet an immovable object, you go around it.
Just across the street is Denver City Hall. It's where council members passed the ban 6 years ago. Supporters, like Councilman Christopher Herndon, said camping bans can actually help homeless individuals. He claimed a similar ordinance in Colorado Springs got hundreds of people off the streets.
160 went back to their families. 35 went to rehabilitation programs for drug and alcohol. 80 went to subsidized housing. 150 got jobs. We reached out to 610 campers and 435 didn't return to homelessness.
The meeting was stopped several times by outbursts from the audience.
I'm giving you 10 seconds.
Mr. President.
I need order right now.
Councilman Paul Lopez voted against the ordinance. He said Denver residents shouldn't be afraid of homeless people.
This proposal is wrong because it punishes the poor for being poor.
Back at Civic Center Park, Jerry Burton shared with the crowd how his life has turned around since the days when he slept here. He's got a home again and a job. and overturning the ban is a chief priority for him.
It will give people the right to rest without being interrupted by or harassed by the policeman. It will also give them the right to share food without being breaking the law. It will also give them a right to just to be themselves, just to be a human being.
Now it's up to Denver voters to decide. In May, the ban on homeless camping will show up on the municipal ballot as the Right to Survive initiative. I'm Scott Franz in Denver.
When was the last time you sat down and wrote a letter? Not a text, not an email, but an actual piece of paper that you folded up and put into an envelope and sealed and sent off with a postage stamp, if you even remember what those are. If you're like most people, it's probably been a while, but KUNC's Stacey Nick found a place where you can take that time to sit and write a letter.
On the first Sunday of each month, a little placeholder is put on several of the tables in the coffee shop at Wolverine Farm Letterpress and Public House in Fort Collins. It reads, "Table reserved for Letter Writing Club." Also on the tables, everything you'd need to write a letter or type one. On an old-fashioned typewriter, Melissa Cox is writing a letter to a friend who's off at college.
Hi, Caroline. I'm writing this on a real typewriter. Isn't that exciting? I'm sorry that this is so messy. Apparently, typewriters are not easy to use. We all miss you so much. Fort Collins isn't the same without you here. I'm sure she'll love it. I know she misses our friend group a ton, and so I think it'll be special for her to receive something that's more than just a text message.
For the 16-year-old, this is admittedly a little bit about the novelty. But for her mom, Carrie, there's something about the intimacy of a letter.
The words matter, of course, but knowing that someone's actually touched that paper, I like that.
For friends Lindsay Brady and Carrie Levy, coming to the Letter Writing Club was an opportunity for them to connect with each other, even though they both live in Fort Collins.
Well, I saw it on Facebook, and I indicated that I was interested, and Carrie saw that, and then we decided to come together.
Generally, we think Facebook is bad, but I texted saying, see, sometimes it's useful.
You saw this on Facebook, and then you texted to come to an event for letter writing.
We'll FaceTime about it later.
For Levy, writing letters has been a welcome distraction. Her newborn has been in the NICU for the past 4 months. So on this day, she's writing a letter to her 4-year-old daughter.
And it says, "Dear Olivia, I'm so proud of the smart and kind person you are. Mommy loves you to the moon and back, as deep as the ocean, as tall as the mountains, as big as the world. Love, Mom."
She hopes her daughter keeps this letter, the way she kept letters when she was young.
When I was in 8th grade, and I have probably, if I could find it, a box of letters, we would go back and forth, like loosely lined paper. Oh my God, I forgot about that. Oh my God.
And there's the connection, because there's just something about letters, something that as we're talking, we realize we all have in common. Letters that you can unfold and read years later, they matter. Consider me inspired. Signing off fondly, Stacey Nick, KUNC.
The new Japanese movie Shoplifters won the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival last May and has since played at many other film festivals in this country. KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz teaches film and television at CU Denver. He says it's the best film he's seen this year.
You might even say it stole his heart.
Aw.
Early in Hirokazu Koreeda's astonishing Shoplifters, a man and a boy walk along a Tokyo street. It's nighttime and it's cold. They come upon a little girl, maybe 5 years old, who sits alone, shivering and hungry. They want to take her to her home, which is just behind her. But from that place, they hear a man and woman arguing, along with the sounds of the man beating the woman, and both of them yelling about how neither of them wants this child. So the man and boy take the girl to their home. Grandma feeds her and attends to the bruises on her arms and legs. She becomes part of their large and unruly household. It's of course illegal, but wrong is something else. It then turns out that the group of people living in this cramped apartment are not a family, in the technical sense of blood relations. That's not a father and son on the nighttime street. It's an older man and a boy he found some time ago, also abandoned and mistreated. The older woman is no one's grandmother, at least in this group. This is a bunch of random people who found each other, live together, and survive through a combination of odd jobs, the old woman's pension, a bit of fraud, and shoplifting. The movie opens with that man teaching the boy how to shoplift. It's a crime, and it's also, in its way, a happy bonding experience for the two. Shoplifters is one of the great ambiguous experiences in the movies. The man and boy become like father and son through a fully illegal activity. The apartment is a hodgepodge of stuff, mats on the floor, boxes, and junk. The mother figure and the little girl talk while the mother's in the tub, in a grody-looking bathroom of broken tiles and crud. It's hardly a picturesque location, but what happens there is a profound human contact that does both characters a lot of good. It's an imperfect world that Corrieta draws. One young woman filches stuff from her job. Another does intimate conversations in a sex club, separated from clients by mirrors so that the men can see her, yet she can't see them. But she, too, crosses the arbitrary boundaries of her job to have a genuine encounter with a needy young man. Corrieta says that he shot the film so that there were three layers in every shot, which turns out to mean that just about every image in the film is itself filled with contradictions. So you find yourself continually readjusting how you see and think about the people and the action on screen. Shoplifters is also about what you don't see. There are visual indications of affection and connection, but feeling itself is invisible. And the uncanny experience of the movie is that you search for what cannot be seen. You might find that the film unseats many of your assumptions about human life and asks that you redefine and rearrange feeling and thought. It's obvious from the start that this existence can't continue. It's unsustainable. Even the abusive parents of the little girl, in full phony parental hypocrisy, are bound to call the police about their missing child. Grandma can't go on forever. Shoplifters can get caught. People living this eccentrically in the middle of a city are bound to be noticed. Corrieta also says about the picture that he hopes his audience will grow aware of the gap between how they see the situation compared to the official investigators. The detectives ask all the questions they should ask, but it's clear that they're the wrong questions. Notions of right and wrong and what's good or bad for people don't always work and don't always get to what's really at issue. And the movie hits with its toughest paradox, that separation may be the proof of connection. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mopshevitz.
This has been Colorado Edition, made possible with support from RKUNC members. If you enjoy listening and you're not a member, you can make a tax-deductible gift in any amount anytime you like at KUNC.org. Our show this week was produced by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Carly Huckles. News director Catherine Welch contributed to our show along with editors Brian Larson and Ashley Jeffcoat, who also manages digital.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana. We also heard Dr. Turtle, Always the Tease Made, Never the Tease, Butterfly in the Stomach by Titan Mara, Robert Abraham with Soul Burned Away,
Robbie Reverb with Bling Bong, Blue Dot Sessions with Volantis, Broke for Free with Warm Up Suit, Enough to Kill a Horse by Steve Combs, and our outro music is Good Grief by Ryan Little.
If you enjoy what you're hearing, make sure you don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or do that wherever you get your podcasts.
And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.